Hello and welcome to Collected, the podcast about writing from the Royal Literary Fund. There is only one genre in fiction, writes Matt Haig in The Humans. The genre is called book. In this episode on the theme My True Genre, we talk to Royal Literary Fund fellows who reject or challenge the idea of classifying books by type in their work. John Kay finds the concept of genre suspect, not least because the field he works in is often hard to define.
I'm always a bit suspicious of this business of genres and every writing having to conform to a particular genre and feeling nervous about crossing from one genre to another. I do have a genre in the sense that I write non-fiction. I've never attempted to write fiction or imaginative literature, creative literature, poetry and so on. I've always been quite happy writing non-fiction, and I get enormous satisfaction from having managed to capture in a sentence or a paragraph exactly what it is I'm trying to say about something purely. So, I mean, that may sound rather mundane, but that's in non-fiction, that's about as near to a sort of major boost, reward that you get, is having managed to express yourself really clearly. But within this non-fiction or fiction thing, there are all sorts of different kinds of genres, and non-fiction obviously covers things like biography, history, travel, war books and so on. I don't see any major problem about moving between these different genres, and I'd like to think of myself as a writer, not as a historian or a biographer or whatever.
The slipperiness of non-fiction came home to Kay when he found himself eligible to enter a prize for debut works, despite having published more than 30 books.
I have just recently completed the nearest thing to a biography that I've ever written, and I was asking one of the people who runs the Biographers Club, I know they have a prize for first biography, I said, well, could I enter my book as a first biography, although it was actually my 30th book or something, but it was indeed my first biography. They said, yeah. And I thought, well, perhaps that was a bit unfair, because presumably the first biographers are usually in their 20s, and they have probably have more need of the boost of winning a prize like that than I do. So I've read this biography, but it isn't really a biography. It's more of a quest. It's about a man who may have invented his entire life story. And so the purpose of the book is to try and discover how much of what he wrote about was true, was factual, and how much of it was pure invention. And so it's a kind of biographical quest, but not really history. It's not really travel, though it certainly involves those things. I have written books which are more straightforward histories and also which are more like travelogues. And also written with my late wife, two encyclopedias. And I don't really see any difficulty about moving between genres. It's just, I think it's quite difficult to move between fiction and non-fiction. If you get a name for writing histories and so on, no one's going to be particularly excited when you propose a novel. You're going to have to convince them that you could write a novel. And similarly, I imagine a novelist might have the same problem if he proposed writing a history. So you get typecast in a way by your publishers and by your readership and so on. So it's quite difficult to make that jump from non-fiction to creative literature. But within either creative literature or non-fiction, I don't think the genres are particularly important.
Fellow non-fiction writer Horatio Clare considers the difficulty his genre poses booksellers and marketing professionals to be part of its essence.
I've sort of led myself to believe that I'm essentially a travel writer who writes children's books, but I think in my head, of course, I'm a novelist. I'm a Booker, a prize-winning novelist, and I love poetry, and I think if I could be anything, I'd be a poet. But in terms of what I actually do, I guess it's travel. It's creative non-fiction. Yeah. And travel's where I find my material. It's somewhere on the line between... Well, it crosses everything. It's biography, it's place, it's nature. It doesn't particularly want to sit anywhere on a bookshop table. I mean, you can generally find my stuff in lots of different places in a bookshop. And I guess Running for the Hills, my first book, which starts as a novel and ends as a kind of biography, having gone through a stage of memoir, is my sort of truest book. I guess if you only write one book, that's the one I'd write. Or that's the one I do write. And I do love to make it up. You know, I love to set a scene as much as the next person. But I also started off thinking I was very unimaginative and really just took dictation from life. I mean, if you look at some of Dylan Thomas's poems, he that's what he does too. But I do it in a more pedestrian way, I think.
Meanwhile, Ian Thompson also sees non-fiction as blurring distinctions, with elements of fiction writing often sneaking in under the radar.
I work in this field called creative non-fiction that really kind of accommodates a lot of subgenres: the personal essay, travel writing, reportage, memoir, confession, anecdote, wiki page entries, notebooks, aphorisms, poetry, you know, why not, film scripts. So it's all a load of these things. The bottom line is that whatever it is that I write, it has to show literary potential. Otherwise, it would be non-creative non-fiction. It wouldn't be proper writing. And really, I teach this thing, creative non-fiction, at the University of East Anglia, and I'm always asked what creative non-fiction is, and I always say, look, it's very porous. It can be a lot of different things, all the things I've mentioned here. But really, in the end, it has to be well written. It has to be good writing. It has to engage with the reader.
In Thompson's view, it is as though non-fiction is a rebellious craft, doing the opposite to what its name specifies.
I guess a characteristic of my genre, non-fiction, is that it sometimes tends to blur the distinctions between fiction and non-fiction. I mean, of course, any piece of writing is necessarily a fashioning and shaping of events. I love the etymology of the word fiction, from the Latin fingere, to mould, to shape or contrive. But we don't, I think, expect non-fiction to distort in the same way, let's say, fiction does. The truth is, of course, it does distort. I'm thinking here of Edmund Gosse's Edwardian memoir, Father and Son, written when Gosse was nearly 60 years old, and it recounts all these conversations that had apparently taken place when Gosse, the author, was a prepubescent child. Had these conversations been made up? Of course they had. To me, writers like John Donne, Montaigne, Sir Thomas Browne, Francis Bacon, and the experimental London novelist B.S. Johnson were all in their different ways writers of non-fiction, of creative non-fiction. They wrote truth-telling essays, sermons and verse of great literary distinction and craft in a way that mere journalism, say, cannot be considered creative non-fiction, cannot be considered literature.
To Charles Boyle, the concept of genre is rather laughable.
Here's a genre joke that I suddenly remember today. It comes from a film by David Hare called Weatherby that I was made in the 1980s and I saw a few weeks ago. Judi Dench plays a character working at the British Library outpost in Weatherby, which is in the north of Yorkshire. And she's giving a car ride to a man who enthuses about second-hand bookshops and develops a complicated theory about the people who frequent second-hand bookshops as being also the kind of people who might well be involved in serial murders. And at one point he turns to Judi Dench and he says, "Do you like murder?" And the Judi Dench character says, "Not really, but I prefer it to romance." I think genre is often less important to the writer than to everybody else involved in publishing, such as prize organisers, such as booksellers. Chain bookshops often label their shelves by genre. So you have fiction and you have poetry and you have self-help and you have history and you have politics. And I myself have written in one or two of these genres. I've written some poetry and some fiction, and I've written a little journalism. I once had a column in the local newspaper, unpaid, which was entitled On the Boil. But at the moment, what I feel currently happiest writing fits none of those specific genres at all. If I was asked to tick a box in a list of genres, I'd probably tick the box that says none of the above, or maybe the one that says whatever.
That said, Boyle recognises that cross-genre writing poses problems for publishers and can lead to books missing out on recognition.
There does seem to be a current, is fashion the right word? It's certainly a good time for cross-genre writing. I'm thinking about the books that often combine a bit of memoir. They are part essay, they're part documentary, they may even be part fiction, they may even include visual elements. I myself am writing a book that's part biography, part travel essay, and most of it's in fact a kind of fiction set in the afterlife. This, for me, is the kind of writing that I'm interested in reading and also the kind of interested in writing, and for booksellers it must be infuriating. I was at an event a few months ago where a writer, a very good one, was reading from her book, and at the end of the event the person who was introducing her asked her, well, actually, your book, is it a novel or is it a collection of short stories? And the writer turned to the introducer and said, well, it's kind of just writing, isn't it? Whether that particular book that that writer was reading from was labelled novel or short stories on the cover turns out to be quite important, actually, because I think with that book, the publisher found it not eligible for certain prizes because he hadn't labelled it a novel on the cover.
Short story writer Laura Hurd finds herself frustrated by the hierarchy that often sees her chosen genre devalued or dismissed.
The thing I've never understood about short stories is why people don't seem to respect them as much as they do novels. A lot of people seem reluctant to read short stories. And even a writer like Stephen King, the short story collections he's written sell a fraction of the number that his novels do, even though a lot of it's the short stories that are made into films and things. I'm not sure why people don't give them a chance. You know, there's such a passion for them in places like Canada. But there are, you know, some great magazines. And when I first started writing poetry and short stories, you were only allowed to send it to one at a time. It was really bad patter if you were to, you know, send the same story off to several people and just waiting to see if one of them responded. Two, if you got the photocopied rejection slip. Three, if they actually took the time to just write a little bit about the story. A place that was great for the Iron magazine, it used to be very generous. I don't know if they ever published me, but I used to send them everything because the editor used to always give really constructive criticism and it meant so much. And then on the odd occasions that your work was accepted to be published, it was fantastic. And, you know, my first main story that I wrote was to Rebel Inc. magazine after I'd been to see a reading there. And it was just luck that the editor, Kevin Williamson, was so encouraging about my work. He accepted the story that I sent and told me to send more, suggested magazines to send other stories to, and agreed to publish my first novella and short story collection. But just short stories will always be my passion. And I just wish more publishers would give them more time too.
Julian Turner shares Hurd's frustration and laments the lack of recognition commonly given to poetry.
Poetry is not well regarded. When books come out, they're not particularly noticed, or people do not think well of the form. And that is it's a big sadness for me because, you know, like, I think in my mind I sort of, probably like most poets, have a really heightened sense of the value of what poetry is. And I think this is a perpetual source of frustration for poets because, I mean, think about Blake, who died in penury and without much acknowledgement of, you know, his skills. He did have a group of fans gathered around him in the years of his life, but and he did work every day, like all day, at what he was doing. But, you know, we only just now, 200 years later, beginning to understand what he was getting at. And it's like, well, how lonely is that, having to be so unacknowledged, really, that, you know, you're on your own, really, pretty much. And you don't really have peers to talk to about it, because your own, what you're trying to say is unique, like, for everyone. Everyone who writes is trying to say something unique, because we're all different. So there is no one to share it with, in a way. So if you combine the two things, that what you're doing is essentially very lonely activity, and then that you're not going to really have an audience for it in a way that is rewarding or satisfying, unless you're very lucky, unless other people really do take to you in your lifetime. So you combine those two things and you add it to the fact that people don't really notice now what poets say. It is all a very sad situation.
Nevertheless, Turner recognises that poets may bear some responsibility for their genre's poor status.
To some extent, we're responsible for that, having had not much to say, really, essentially. And I do think that needs to change. I think poets need to take their subject matter more seriously, really, and be more relevant to more people. But at the moment, there isn't a mechanism for enabling audiences to connect easily to poetry, and the means that we're promoting at the moment for that, like poetry slams and performance poetry, they're good in themselves, but they lack the gravitas, really, sometimes, that you need, that poetry really does need to add to the mixture. So yes, we're in a bit of a mess, it seems to me, and one of the things we really lack is people, good critics, you know? It's like there aren't that many good critics around who can see and value what's been produced. And there's a bit of a confusion as well of what is good poetry. I think those sort of standards are changing. So we're working in a chaotic system which doesn't have very good sets of guidelines and things, none of which helps the situation.
For Marina Benjamin, the key lies in finding the spark of passion that will ignite a project.
My spiritual home or true genre is memoir. And I've sort of arrived at that through a more straightforward non-fiction. I find that I always seem to find a source of passion for my subject in my own experience, and that's the way I can hook into it and mine it. So the first time I attempted to do that, I think, was rather self-consciously in Rocket Dreams, which was a sort of elegy for the end of the space age, but also a childhood memoir. And, I mean, I don't know if everyone would read it that way, but when I look at it, I see it as a homage to the 1970s, to particular ways of thinking and being in the world, and particular attitudes to nature, and a particular cast of optimism and pessimism about the way things were going. So ostensibly, it's about the imaginative escapades of a space age that by that time, when I was growing up, had already been grounded. So instead of imagining that we'd be colonising Mars, there were floating colonies in near-Earth orbit. Instead of encountering aliens, it was the great era of fantasising alien abductions. Instead of trashing the Earth in favour of moving elsewhere, we got Gaia, or perhaps more obscurely, we got Noetics. And those, I suppose, rather little-known areas of where the space age came home to land or came back to roost really interested me, because I thought that they informed the culture of the 1970s. I thought the space age was woven into it in ways that hadn't been explored, and that I could access by remembering the cast of mind of my childhood.
Like Ian Thompson, Benjamin believes that blending and blurring lie at the heart of the most successful non-fiction narratives.
I think there are lots of writers who are working this kind of blended narrative groove. and also even mixing it up with autofiction. I think it's a very exciting time to be in this area. It's very experimental form, and it has attached to it ventures as bold as any that you will find in fiction. The challenge, of course, is to make sure that there's artistry involved in the expression of memoir so that it's not just a recording of events. There's a real delving and scratching around for story, and then the writing of that in, needs to be crafted, I think, in a way that is compelling and pulls you along in the way that we would expect a novel to pull you along. The best of these memoirists are, like novelists, experimenting very bravely with form. You know, they'll use fragmented voices, broken timelines, they'd mash up fact and fabulation, memory, supposition and speculation. And really, in many ways, I don't think there's been a better time to be a non-fiction writer.
Michael Macmillan goes further, claiming that the best genre writing always contains an element of the new.
One is aware of genres in terms of writing, theatre, fiction, poetry. And on some level, one respects these kind of boundaries and the different kind of rules and regulations that exist, and on some level, I don't respect them. Because in some sense, the approach is very similar. There are distinctions made between these genres. So for instance, I began as a playwright, and then I've morphed into theatre writer or theatre maker. And now I look at my practice in terms of making work. And that can be in terms of curating, in terms of theatre, in terms of writing essays. One of the interesting things about genre, if you look at music, for instance, and you can apply this to art as well, is that in the repetition, sometimes music emerges through repetition. Always in the new repetition, there's something new emerging. So throughout different genres, always new things emerge, something emerges. And that is what is exciting about testing and pushing the limits of what genre are and is, because something new always emerges.
Michael Macmillan there, concluding this episode of Collected, which was produced by Anne Morgan. The other writers featured in this episode were John Kay, Horatio Clare, Ian Thompson, Charles Boyle, Laura Hurd, Julian Turner and Marina Benjamin. There's more information about their work on the Royal Literary Fund website. Coming up next time, four writers discuss the knotty question of craft and technique. We hope you'll join us.